fans, and welcome to another episode of Bulls HQ, a Chicago Bulls podcast on the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Thank you again for joining me on this episode of the show. Hopefully you're all hanging in there without the basketball. It's been tough for me, I'll give you that much, but we've got the FIBA World Cup coming up shortly, but it has been hard to sort of been going on with these last few months without Bulls basketball, but that doesn't mean we can't necessarily get on here on the pod and talk Bulls, because there is always a topic to discuss. And joining me today is my old friend Kevin Ferrigan. We're going to talk win projections, not only for the NBA at large, but specifically for the Bulls and where they're sort of situated headed into this season. We're going to look at where Vegas has them, where a few analytical models has them, and of course where Kevin has them too. So let's bring him in. Kevin, thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark.
No, I'm glad you're on. How's the offseason treating you, man? Are you as deprived of basketball as I am? I'm in a different time zone, so when I wake up, I check my Twitter feed. It's about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, typically when I wake up in Chicago at least, and I see too many people talking about NFL, too many people talking about baseball as if that's actually a sport, and I don't know, I'm just sort of hanging for basketball to be back. But how are you in the States, being in Chicago now, based in Chicago? What's it like to be there, and are you missing basketball like I am?
Yeah, I definitely am. I used to be more of a general sports fan probably 10 years ago, but I've really stopped caring about most other sports besides basketball, and specifically the NBA. Like, I'll watch college basketball mostly just to see who's going to be potentially a prospect for the NBA, but even then, I'm not watching a ton of games. I'd be lying if I said that I was. And so, like, it's really pretty much all about the NBA, and I'm pretty hard up right now not having NBA basketball. I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't say that the WNBA is on right now, but frankly, like, I haven't followed the WNBA as closely as I probably should, and I don't know the players well enough to, like, feel like I know what I'm watching, really. You know, basketball is basketball, but I don't know. With the NBA, I have all these years of familiarity with players and all that history. And with the WNBA, I feel like I basically start from scratch and learning all that stuff. So at some point, I need to actually dive in and do it, especially to get me through these non-NBA months. It's rough out here. There's not a lot going on the NBA front, especially with the free agency stuff and all that wrapping up as quickly as it did. You know, we had Summer League, which Summer League I caught a little bit of, but even that was, like, not too exciting. Zion getting hurt, like, in game one and then sitting out was a pretty big bummer. And then, you know, the Bulls not having Wendell playing and Kobe looking kind of, well, he looked okay, but his jump shot was trash, which made him look a lot worse than I think he is. But at least Daniel Gafford looked good.
Yeah, I mean, that's the upside, I suppose. But to your point, like, I was traveling through Europe during Summer League. I thought I was going to be missing a lot, but ultimately I didn't really, because it was kind of boring, even beyond the Bulls and beyond Zion. Like you mentioned, he didn't play much, but not many of the top picks really played. So, I mean, Brandon Clark was pretty much the only guy really to get hyped about. But Summer League was kind of boring, but I'm actually kind of happy that the World Cup is coming up. I'm sort of hanging for that. Team USA is down in Australia next week or the week after, so I'm going to that game. But the World Cup is approaching, nice. So that might help us a little bit through August, September. But yeah, the next couple of weeks are a bit rough, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, you're not really getting the full Team USA experience. It seems like everybody's dropping out, NBA basketball and live and in person is, or NBA level basketball, I guess I should say, live and in person is pretty good, even if it isn't the usual star-studded cast that you get with Team USA. But yeah, the World Cup, I think, will be interesting, if only because because Team USA isn't sending its best, and so that should make the other countries a bit more competitive than we typically see. So that'll be interesting, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I looked at the USA team today and I was actually thinking to myself, I really hope they do lose. This is obviously a lot of my listeners are from the US, so they probably won't take kindly to me saying that. But if you're outside the US, big world competition on, everyone's just rooting against the US at that point. So I would love to see them lose. But having said that, the Australian team just got released not long ago, and I'm not too thrilled with how they've selected their players as well. So I'm not sure if we're much of a medal chance either, but it's just basketball. Basketball's back, and not yet, but it will be back soon. So that'll sort of fill me over until we roll around to training camp and preseason and those sorts of things in September, October. But I didn't get you on to talk about the World Cup. I got you on to talk about the Chicago Bulls, who I guess it's a new iteration of Chicago Bulls to a degree. At least it feels like that. The team hasn't really changed that much, but at the same time, it just sort of feels like something is different about this team. And I guess it's the veteran experience to a degree. So I want to talk about the Bulls, obviously, but I also want to talk about win projections and where several markets and analytical models have the Bulls sort of situated going into next season. I brought you on because you have, throughout your years sort of covering the league and just watching the league, you've always had an analytical focus to how the game goes, and rather than having me just sort of sit here and try to work out what all these models sort of mean and what they're telling me, I thought I'd bring you on to actually make some sense of it on, or to me at least. I'm sure my listeners are much more versed on it than I am, but I wanted to talk win projections in particular with you. And so let's dive into that. And I guess most people have seen what Vegas is sort of suggesting the Bulls will be doing next season. It's definitely an improvement, but the Caesars Sportsbook, for example, has the Chicago Bulls winning record at 30.5 next season, 30.5 wins. Westgate has 33.5 wins. 538's Carmelo has 37 wins. So they're there or thereabouts. And just, I guess, your initial impressions of that. Do you think that that Vegas and even 538, do you think they're somewhat comparable, or at least something to what you would suggest? I know you have your model that you have that you've tracking the Bulls in terms of what you expect from them in terms of wins. So maybe you can dive into that too.
Yeah. So what I've been working on, it's still not a complete project. It's still not complete. I'm still tweaking. But where I'm at now, I feel pretty decent about. But I put together this metric called tracking plus minus, pretty similar to an idea that Andrew Johnson had from, he's one of the writers from Nylon Calculus. He's at Counting Baskets on Twitter. He put together this thing called the player tracking plus minus a couple years ago, back when the tracking data was relatively new and there wasn't that much plus minus impact data to compare it to. Now we've got about 6 years of player tracking data on the NBA site, so a little bit more sample size there. And so I basically tried to do an update to what he had and to incorporate, and I'm trying out new variables to incorporate to get the best sort of metric I can that is based on the tracking data and box score statistics that doesn't necessarily incorporate, you know, the regularized adjusted plus minus sort of framework. And under, so I've, you know, put together numbers for the last 6 years, and then I took the last 3 years to project what guys would look like for this year based on basically weighting last year basically four times what 3 years ago was weighted, and then the middle year, so 2 years ago, is weighted about half of what last year would be weighted. And then there's some mean regression, and then there's an aging curve thrown onto that. So Thaddeus Young, for instance, is expected to drop off a little bit because he's 31. Wendell Carter, he's only 20 years old. He's expected to have the largest improvement in terms of his impact metrics for next year for the Bulls, just based on his age. And so that's kind of like how the metric is set up. My numbers came out at 34.5 wins, so a lot closer to what Vegas thinks than some of the other projection systems. I know you mentioned 538. I think they had the Bulls at
37.
Yeah, 37. And Jacob Goldstein, I think he had either 38 or 39, depending on when you were looking at his numbers, they changed a little bit because his are interesting because he takes a projection of basically margin of victory and then runs it through the schedule. So moves that other teams made prior to the Bulls essentially finalizing their roster might have had an effect on what the Bulls' projected record was. And I think a lot of folks do it that way. Some places just project a margin of victory and then essentially extrapolate from that what your expected win total would be, because it doesn't really change that much. You know, margin of victory correlates pretty strongly with win percentage, but a lot of folks now run it through the schedule. But yeah, so my, I guess, metric right now is a little bit more bearish on the Bulls than some of the projection systems, but slightly more optimistic than Vegas is. And, you know, 34.5 wins, that's basically a 12.5 win improvement on last year, which I think would be, you know, a pretty sizable jump. But also the Bulls were super unhealthy last year, so I think they're due for some improvement just by virtue of that.
I guess my follow-up question was going to be, what inputs does yours have versus sort of Vegas and those sorts of things? But you sort of touched on it there. And I guess I kind of like the way you've gone about it, looking at it from a player level, whereas maybe some of these other bigger sort of establishments may just look at it more from a holistic team point of view and margin of victories and running that against schedules and whatever it may be. But it seems like you've put a little bit more, I won't say analysis, but you've gone into that a little bit more, in a little bit more detail, where you've gone down to that player level, sort of adjusted it at that player level, what each player's TPM will be, to the point where you've rolled that up to almost a team level to get to your 35 wins.
Yeah, so I mean, I think like the way that I am doing it is you know, essentially coming up with an estimated player value and then rolling that up to the team level. I know for a fact that that's how Jacob does his. He has his player impact plus minus is his sort of player value metric that then gets translated to a team level strength or margin of victory projection, which this is kind of like the hidden secret sauce of win projections that is equally important, if not more important sometimes, to getting this right is projecting minutes accurately,
yeah,
which is very tricky. Obviously, any injuries are going to throw you off, or unexpected injuries. And so you're giving your best guess, and you have to make some assumptions around relative health and who's more prone to injury and those sorts of things. I think my projections for the Bulls are, you know, the minutes are relatively, I wouldn't say they're like super optimistic. I also wouldn't say that they're very pessimistic. Like if the Bulls have an injury year from hell like they did last year, then they're going to be in trouble, because my minutes projections, I have Otto Porter, Thad Young, Thomas Satoransky, Wendell, Lowry Markkanen, Zach LaVine, all estimated to be playing at or around 2,000 minutes or more, which is, you know, a pretty decent number of minutes to be playing in a year. I mean, some guys play up to 3,000 minutes if they play all 82 and they're playing a lot of minutes of games. But, you know, projecting that or assuming that wouldn't be the smartest thing. So, you know, you have to project some, you know, minor injuries here and there. But like, for instance, I have Chris Dunn playing 1,000 minutes. Chris Dunn is actually, he's not great by the, you know, the metrics that the impact metric that I have, but he's, you know, basically just under a slightly below a league average player. And you know, that versus playing a player like I estimate Kobe White to be, I think he's more going to be like a replacement level player because he's a rookie, and rookie point guards tend to struggle. If you replace that 1,000 minutes of Chris Dunn with Kobe White, my projections would be, you know, a little bit more pessimistic. I already have Kobe White playing about 750 minutes, but, you know, if you gave him all the minutes I'm projecting for Chris Dunn, assuming that the Bulls, you know, dump Chris Dunn or don't, you know, play him very much, then their projection would actually get worse, which is probably confusing to people because the opinion about Chris Dunn around Bulls fandom now is that he kind of sucks. And I don't think he really sucks. I don't think he's a great fit with Zach LaVine, and that's kind of the issue. But in this kind of system, if he plays less, it actually makes the Bulls worse. So that might be, I guess, slightly counterintuitive.
No, I mean, that makes complete sense to exactly what you said before, the fact that he's a 19-year-old point guard who is still learning to be a point guard and obviously will be learning to be an NBA player. So the more you rely on him, particularly early on, if you were to trade Chris Dunn right at the start of the season or maybe a couple months in, then you're relying on a player potentially who doesn't have that value or doesn't have that experience to, and if you're pouring minutes into that guy, there's definitely more risk associated with that. So I think that makes complete sense to me, at least.
Yeah, I guess it's just that all this is just to say that Chris Dunn is not a replacement level player. He's, at least, you know, as I have him sort of graded out in this metric, he's more like just below average, which is, you know, I think a lot better than he kind of gets credit for. But I think part of the issue too is that there are so many, you know, capable good point guards in the league that it makes him look kind of worse by comparison. But he's a, you know, a decent defensive player. From an all-in-one impact metric perspective, his offense is, you know, viewed as being not great, but, you know, slightly below average, as opposed to a complete and total disaster, which is, I think, how his offense sometimes gets talked about because he can't shoot that well. But, you know, he does bring some things. He's probably the Bulls' best or maybe second best playmaker for others besides Zach. And I think Chris is probably a little bit better, honestly. But, you know, you could convince me either way with that. Zach definitely, I mean, they both want to score first, even though Chris is very, like, adamant that he's a point guard. They both are more focused on getting their own buckets than setting anybody else up, but they're, you know, they're the best that the Bulls have. I think Satoransky might be better at that than either of them for next year, but just going based on what the Bulls have had the last few years, they haven't really had that many guys that could break down the defense and create shots for people, which also might be a little bit of an issue for them next year, because I still think that as capable a player as Satoransky is, he's not a guy that really puts a lot of pressure on a defense. And so really, Zach is still your best player for that. And Zach is not a elite or even very good passer or setup man for his teammates. Maybe he comes back with that in his bag. He is a guy that has gotten a lot better over the course of his career. I think he deserves credit for that. But, you know, I think if he's your top playmaker, I think it doesn't necessarily spell great things for your team's offense.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly fair. I want to talk about the players in a second, because you've obviously broken this down at a player level, like I mentioned. But before we do, let's tell the listeners about this week's sponsor. Football season is here, people. It's time to start placing your bets for NFL and college football. Blue Wire is teaming up with Sports Information Traders and the legend John Price, one of the world's most successful sports bettors, so our listeners are given the chance to make more money on football this season. Go to sportsinformationtraders.com/blue and get the college football and NFL futures play and make up to 15 times your money for only a $99 investment. Last year, Sports Information Traders correctly predicted the Clemson Tigers to win the college football championship, making one client alone $110,000. The year before that, Kurt Presley of Sports Information Traders made $1 million with a preseason wager on the Philadelphia Eagles to win the Super Bowl. John Price and the Sports Information Traders team can guide you on the best ways to make money on future bets and preseason football betting picks. You get all of that for just $99 and the opportunity to make 15 times your money. It's totally worth getting Sports Information Traders betting picks. Sports Information Traders has been featured in ESPN, Gambling911.com, Entrepreneur Magazine, and many more. John Price has been successfully making money betting on sports for over 20 years. Make a big return for a small investment with Sports Information Traders Future Picks. Get started now by going to sportsinformationtraders.com/blue. Again, make sure you go to sportsinformationtraders.com/blue to have your chance at a 15 times return this football betting season. All right, back to the podcast now. And like I mentioned before, you go down into detail. And look, you've already explained it, the fact that you not only have sort of just projected what this team's wins will be. You've set us 34 and a half. Well, let's just call it 35 wins, which to me, you mentioned before that it might be a little bit pessimistic versus some of the other ones. But I think that's there or thereabouts. I think a 35 to 37 window kind of makes sense to my ears, at least. But like I said, you go into the detail where you dive into the players, you sort of build up what you think their season may look like to the point where you sort of extrapolate it down to that team level. You've projected roughly 35 wins for the Bulls. But to do that, like I said, you go down to that player level. And I'm interested to hear from you how your metrics have sort of, well, essentially what they've calculated in terms of which players will be essentially giving the Bulls the most value. And to me, when I saw your list, it wasn't too surprising, but I'm interested to hear a little bit more thoughts as to who you have in your sort of your top five or so and why you have those players there. Maybe some other names that maybe some listeners will be surprised to hear aren't in the top five, aren't necessarily in there.
So for in terms of both impact per possession and sort of overall value or wins created, for next year, I have Otto Porter as the Bulls' most valuable player for next year. He projects to be a very solid, pretty good player. I got him at roughly 5.5 wins created. And then next would be Thaddeus Young. And I think it's interesting. So I think Otto kind of has a reputation as being like a good defensive player, and my metric is a little bit more skeptical of his defense. It has him as basically a league average defender, but brings a lot of value on offense as a floor spacer and just an overall efficient player who doesn't make a lot of mistakes. So that's where, he's basically a good offensive player, average defensive player, which translates to, you know, a very solid basically like a plus 1.25 per 100 possessions player. And then Thad Young is kind of the reverse. He's basically a league average offensive player and then brings value on the defensive end that is roughly equivalent to what you get from Otto on the offensive end, I think, which makes somewhat intuitive sense. He plays more on as a big guy as opposed to Otto, who's on the wing. And, you know, been a very good defensive player for a long time. And offensively, he's not a great scorer, and he's not like a tremendous floor spacer. So that's why he's more like league average. He doesn't, again, he's another one that doesn't really make a lot of mistakes offensively. He's a, you know, capable passer, not, you know, great at it or anything, but he's also not going to kill you. And he'll keep the ball moving and make the right play. So, you know, that gets you to about average. Third best player for next year is Tomas Satoransky. He is projected to be a slight positive offensively, so a little bit above average and very slightly below average defensively, which I think jives kind of with the eye test with him. He's not a bad defensive player, but he's also not a super plus, even though he's, you know, got really good size for his position. But he's also, you know, he's projected to play a decent number of minutes. And so he's projected to create about 4.5 wins. Thad Young was 5 wins. So between those three, I guess he had about 15 wins. And then
So just focusing on those three players, I think it's interesting to note, because we say best players, and I guess maybe some fans will have an issue with that when they think of the best players on the team. They'll think Larry Markkanen, they'll think Zach LaVine. Maybe Wendell Carter, but those players are sort of down the list and on your list at least, and I don't think that's unfair, but I think that's completely rational in terms of where we think of these players potentially being the most productive players. I don't know if we're necessarily saying that Thad Young is more talented than Larry Markkanen, but for next season, these guys are probably going to be the more productive player in terms of wins, and I don't know if some fans will find that surprising, maybe they won't, but when I got your list, at least, when I saw Otto Porter Jr. at the top of the list, for a number of reasons, to me, it made sense. I mean, if we just think back to February of last season, where this team completely completely changed its identity. A lot of that had to do with Otto Porter sort of arriving and being the adult in the room to a degree. And I guess Thad Young and Satoransky just add to that. And further to that point, I mean, if you think about Otto Porter, if you think about Thad Young and even Satoransky, the positions they play, they're positions that the Bulls don't necessarily have a ton of experience depth in, to the point where the reliance on these players and the minutes that they play will be heavily productive for the team.
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that is really evident whenever you look at any of like the impact sort of plus minus based metrics is that younger players tend not to be very good or not to be not to be very impactful. That it is the rare player that comes into the league immediately and they can be productive, which is different than being impactful, right? So like Kevin Durant famously was very productive his rookie season, but all of his impact metrics were terrible. And some of that was was team context. He, you know, wasn't on a very good team. And everybody was kind of dragged down by the fact that, you know, it's hard to show positive impact when you're losing every game. But his productivity was, you know, predictive of the fact that he was going to be a star in the future, even though he wasn't having that sort of impact early on. But that's like a story that you see over and over again with these kind of metrics. So I think it's an indication that there are things that the box score doesn't really capture all that well, that is a little bit more captured by some of the little things in this tracking plus minus that I'm using, and also any of the, you know, sort of impact metrics that have an adjusted plus minus component. So that is all to say that, yes, I think Lauri Markkanen is probably the most talented player on the roster, maybe Zach LaVine, at least offensively, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's the most impactful. And it's also about having impact within a role, right? So like Otto Porter, his skill set is perfectly fit and right size for the role that he has in the NBA. You know, he's a spot up shooter, floor spacer who can give you against a closeout. He can do a little bit of playmaking in a pinch and maybe in a pick and roll. Didn't really see that as much with Washington, but he flashed it a little bit last year with the Bulls because they were so desperate for playmaking and like guys to be able to do something with the ball off the dribble. And he had that when he was in college at Georgetown, but he just hadn't really shown it in a long time. But all that to say is that like his skill set is maximized and he's able to provide a great level of impact in that role. Zach LaVine offensively projects to have less of an impact offensively than Otto Porter, which sounds probably kind of ridiculous, but Zach LaVine is probably being pushed to the limits of his skill set and his ability in the role that he has. Like he has been carrying for the Bulls a huge amount of usage because they haven't had great offensive players. And this is one area where I think that he might actually, and you know, if you're looking for reasons for optimism relative to my projections, I think Zach has a couple things. Zach has overperformed his aging curve basically every year that he's been in the league. Like his improvement year over year is greater than you would expect for somebody of his age, and which is kind of remarkable because, you know, he came into the league as a very young player and young players are already projected to improve a lot. But he went from being like one of the very worst from an impact perspective players in the league his first couple of years in the league to now being like, you know, solidly in the middle of the league and offensively, you know, pretty decent. But getting back to what I was kind of getting at is like he's essentially being asked to be the Bulls' number one playmaker. He's being asked to carry this heavy usage, or he has been the last couple of years, and he is not a number one, I don't think. He'll still be basically the Bulls' number one this year, but with a, you know, assuming health, knock on wood, for Lauri Markkanen and Wendell Carter and the rest of the Bulls sort of like top six guys, he's going to have more players that are capable offensively around him than he's had in a while. And I think that that will make a big difference in terms of right-sizing his talent and ability to the role that he's going to be in. I think he'll still struggle a little bit because I don't think he's a number one, but he's not going to be asked to be a number one in the same way that he was the last 2 years, where he was really being asked to do more than he was capable of. So, you know, I think that might mean that he's being sort of maybe a little underrated in sort of these projections, because they're based on past performance, right? And past performance in a different context isn't always perfectly predictive of what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, I mean, that context is super important. So we're not sitting here and saying what we're projecting here is what's going to happen, or based on past performance, the future will sort of roll out just as it's sort of been calculated out. I think everything you sort of noted there is more than fair, and within that context makes complete sense. And to back up your point, Zach LaVine sort of being the number one option when he's sort of playing in lineups where he's got Archie Diakono, Wayne Seldon, maybe Cristiano Felicio, and whoever you want to throw out there at power forward once Larry Markkanen, Wendell Carter Jr., even Otto Porter Jr., once those guys were out with injury. It's a lot different context playing in a lineups like that where your metrics are pretty much screwed, I guess is my point, when you're a player like Zach LaVine who plays most of the season, when you're playing and running outside or running out with those sorts of lineups versus, as you sort of just mentioned, where we hopefully will be expecting him to sort of have more minutes, hopefully with some healthy players in that sort of top six. So I think the perception of who Zach LaVine is, maybe even Larry Markkanen too, I think those two players probably more nationally are probably slept on probably more than what they should be, you know, in comparison to some of the other players maybe Zach LaVine's compared to or not compared to, and the same thing with Larry Markkanen. But one other thing that I wanted to ask you about all these sorts of projections, not just for yourself, but maybe just anyone that's putting these sorts of win projections together, is how much can you factor coaching into this, and can you factor it into all at all in terms of these sorts of metrics? So essentially what I'm asking is how much can someone like Jim Boylan influence how we sort of base our win projections on this not only just the Chicago Bulls, but, you know, coaches all around the league? Because I'm sitting here and I'm looking at your numbers, and 35 wins sounds right to me, and how you've sort of graded out all these players. But I'm just wondering if the range of outcomes maybe change based on a coach like Jim Boylan, who obviously I have a lot of questions about.
Yeah, so that is kind of the big question, among other big questions, but that is one of the big questions with this stuff, is how much does coaching matter, and how much can it impact what to expect from a guy? I mean, to a certain extent, what I was talking about with Zach LaVine in terms of changing his context this year, having an effect on his impact metrics, you can take that micro level observation and expand it out to coaching. Coaches that are really good can provide a completely different context for players to play in, and really maximize what they are and what they look like. So, for instance, I think everybody who was really paying attention before last season and did these kind of projections looked at the Bucks and said, all of the Bucks projections are coming in too low, because all of their historical data, or not all, but a lot of their historical data was based on the fact that they had Jason Kidd as their coach. What I mean by that is that all of these impact metrics and production metrics are like based on past performance. The coaching is almost baked in to a certain extent, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, that
if
makes
the coach doesn't
sense.
Change, the context, that part of the context doesn't really change. You can expect the same projections to hold for them to be slightly more accurate. But in the instance of like the Bucks with going from Jason Kidd to Mike Budenholzer, so going from arguably the worst coach in the league with Jason Kidd, who was clearly not maximizing his roster for a variety of reasons. The defensive system that they played made no sense for their personnel, and their offensive system eschewed three-pointers, despite the fact that you had this monster in Giannis who had all this gravity with the ball in his hands and all you had to do was put shooting around him and he would be able to dunk everything or kick it out for open threes. And that was like, Budenholzer obviously got the buy-in and got guys to do it, but it didn't really take a genius, I don't think, to observe that they should be taking more threes and that running a spaced out system around Giannis made a lot of sense. I don't know why Jason Kidd seemingly couldn't figure that out, but whatever the case, a lot of people that ran the projection systems, you know, still had the Bucks as, you know, possibly like a low 6-7-8 seed coming into this year, just based on the numbers. But the guys that did the best in terms of like win projections said, well, okay, that's what the numbers are telling me, but I'm going to bump them up artificially by X percent because I know that Budenholzer is a very, very good coach, maybe great coach, and they had a really bad coach, and that's going to make a huge difference. Most coaches aren't really bad like Jason Kidd or really great like Mike Budenholzer. Most of them are kind of in the middle. I thought for a little while that Jim Boylan might be like Jason Kidd level bad. I don't know if I still believe that, and he's not changing. So the only players that I would be worried about him affecting their performance really, at least from a projection standpoint, would be Thaddeus Young and Tomas Satoransky, essentially the new guys, the guys that are coming in from other teams where they had different coaching. But I don't think that he's so bad now. I think that he got off to a rough start and I think has figured out some things. And also, I think the other thing that I will say, too, is that I think it was very encouraging that the Bulls hired him some very tenured assistant coaches that could help him out with some of the micro-level strategy stuff and even possibly with implementing some bigger-picture strategy stuff of we have a young team that has shooters. We need to push the pace and let these athletes get out and run. And then the coach there, the defensive coach that they hired, Roy Rogers?
Yeah, Roy Rogers, yeah.
From the Rockets. I think that, you know, getting him a defensive coordinator essentially will be helpful for him because I think that was kind of his responsibility with Fred Hoiberg, but it's hard to be the head coach and be, you know, the defensive coordinator at the same time because the head coach is like really almost like an executive level position for the entire coaching staff. And then you have to delegate the implementation of your bigger picture strategies. And we'll see how he does with that. But I think from a pure, like, how does he impact the projections? I wouldn't expect him to be too different. The only other thing I'll say is that the aging curves for, you know, Lauri Markkanen and Wendell Carter are, because they're so young, do project, you know, a pretty decent amount of improvement for next year. And if he is hindering their development, then that could be an issue because maybe they don't take the leap that they should if he's not doing a good job.
Yeah, everything you've noted there completely on point. So I still remained unchanged on my view. You may have softened on your view, but I'm still thinking he's a bad coach.
I'm trying to be positive here.
Well, look, I'll happily admit that he's done some good things when the change comes through. Obviously, they've talked a good game thus far. What they've said, what they've done in their assistant coaching hirings makes complete sense, as you sort of noted there. But until I see that change on the court, I'll believe it at that point. But I guess that's why I think Jim Boylan, to an extent, is almost the most important figure in this Bulls organization, because I think to a degree he does hold the key as to where this team heads next season. So I think we can talk about win projections as much as we like, but ultimately, I think in a funny way, injuries aside, I think he sort of holds the keys in terms of the range of outcomes of what this team could be next season. So I want to close on this, and this is probably the most important question that I could probably ask you on this topic. When you put together something like this, whether it's at a player level or at a team level, and you, as I sort of said before, you've come up with 35 wins, let's call it that, 34.5, which isn't too dissimilar to what Westgate has at 33.5, 538 had 37. So you're essentially in the middle between those. So it's a number that makes sense to me. But when you see your model spit out 35, and then you have someone like C. Red Fred, who comes on my podcast last week and declares that the Bulls will be winning 44 games next season, potentially even more. Do you sort of put your model in question, knowing that Fred is the oracle of all things, and he can see into the future? And do you sort of put some question into your model to the point where you sort of want to artificially bump it up to that 44 wins?
Well, I'll say two things. I don't know if he's forgotten, but I haven't, that we do have a bet of $100 that if the Bulls make the playoffs, I owe Fred $100, and if they don't, he owes me. I put that bet out on Ricky and Jason's podcast a while, and it took a long time before somebody, I put it out there to anybody, and it took a while, but eventually Fred was the one to come and take the bet on. But given his so far his reluctance to pay up on your bet with him, I'm a little skeptical about whether this is going to actually go down, even if I win.
Oh, that's more than fair to think that.
Yeah. But the other thing that I will say is that I would much rather my model be wrong and the Bulls be better than I think, because, you know, and I got excited when I saw that Jacob Goldstein's model was, I think, relative to Vegas and relative to maybe sort of like talking head perception, a little bit bullish on the Bulls, to make an unintentional pun, and, you know, 538's model being, you know, thinking that the Bulls could win 37 games and be right in the mix for the playoffs. You know, I want that to be the case. And I would love to see, you know, Lowry and Wendell Carter make a big leap, especially Lowry. I think this is a really important year for him. And if he really exceeds all expectations and the Bulls win 44 games, nobody would be happier than me. I run the numbers, and whatever they spit out, I try to contextualize it and say, well, how could this go differently? What do they need to do for this to not be sort of gospel? And the other thing is that, you know, my model's not perfect. No model is perfect. You're attempting to make them better all the time, but, you know, they give you a good ballpark, and Vegas is pretty good at this. If your numbers are in the ballpark of Vegas, it kind of give you a feel for roughly where you should expect teams to be. But I think the other thing to really always remember about these projection systems is there's a lot of uncertainty built into them. One, the minutes projections are obviously very uncertain. Good health or bad health really has a huge play in where teams end up. We don't like to talk about it that much, but it does matter a lot. And then, especially if you're not the Warriors of the last few years, or even like the top teams this year, where there's only, most of them only have two stars. If you are in this environment and you know one of your only two star players gets hurt, you're in trouble fast. Whereas, you know, a lot of teams could get away with injuries if they had, you know, three stars on their team or whatever. Injuries to your top players are always going to have a big impact on how far off you are from these numbers. The other thing is that guys make nonlinear improvements all the time. All of these projection systems assume aging curves that are pretty standard. But like I said, with Zach LaVine, every year he seemingly improves more than what his sort of natural aging curve would suggest. I think Damian Lillard is another guy who, you know, by rights should have started to decline already, given where he's at in his aging curve, but he keeps getting better every single year. So, you know, these projection systems are only as good as the assumptions that they're built on. I think that the logic of most of them is pretty sound, and they give you reasonable results overall. But, you know, when you're talking any one given team, there's always reasons for skepticism and reasons that you can find for optimism that these numbers aren't destiny. And I think that's important to remember.
That is certainly true. And I think that's why you have adopted the moniker Sea Red Kev as well. So I can definitely hear that optimism in your voice when you're talking about the Bulls to a degree. So maybe Sea Red Fred isn't too wrong on that 44. And look, I'm hoping it might cost you 43. It might cost you $100 rather, but I'm hoping the Bulls get 43 wins because he and I have a season-long bet coming up as well for the upcoming season of 44 or more again. So 43 wins would be ideal. You lose your $100, but it would make me happy at least. But
that would be the happiest $100 I've ever lost. If the Bulls surprise and you know win 21 more games than they won last year, I'll take it. I'll sacrifice my $100, no problem.
I'll chip in half of that $100 if they do that. I'll give you 50 of it. So that way you can sort of recoup some of that cost. But I appreciate you coming on and breaking this down with me because it's always interesting not only just to go over our projections of where the Bulls may be headed in the upcoming season, but to go into some of the logic that you've put into it. Obviously, you spend a lot of time doing it. You've got a lot of inputs into it. It's not necessarily just pulling a number out of thin air sort of thing. You actually have put a lot of time into it. So I appreciate you doing that. Where can people sort of keep up with your projections and just your general NBA takes and Bulls takes throughout the season? Where can they follow you online?
Yeah, I mean, Twitter is basically where most of my stuff goes out. I have used to have a website. Now there's some like weird gambling site that's like squatting on it because I let the registration lapse. If you follow me at NBA Couchside on Twitter, then you'll be up to date on anything that I put out because that's where it goes out first.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, man. Like I said before, it's always insightful when you're on the podcast, giving us your view. It's a little bit of a different perspective, but it's one that I definitely value. But yeah, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks again for having me on. Appreciate it.
Okay, Bulls fans, that just about does it for this episode of Bulls HQ. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the show. I appreciate it. As always, you can follow me online at MK Hoops. Follow the podcast at Bulls HQ Pod. 5-star reviews if you get a second on iTunes. That is greatly appreciated, as always. But thank you for tuning into this episode of Bulls HQ. We'll be back again next week. Hopefully, there'll be some more Bulls content for us to go through. I'm sure there will be, particularly with the FIBA World Cup sort of ramping up and maybe, just maybe, I can come back onto this podcast and gloat about Australia defeating the US in the World Cup. Who knows? Maybe that'll happen. Probably not, but we shall see. But like I said, thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week. Speak to you all then, Bulls fans.